The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
An interesting and maybe evocative analogy is that of a magician and a magic trick. If the magic trick is quite good and kind of spectacular, some of us will be mesmerized by it and we'll keep wanting to see it again and again. Like, how did that happen? Or what goes on? And each time it happens, it's kind of like fascinating. But if the magician shows how it's done, then we're not so interested in seeing it again. We lose our interest. So one of the magic tricks that our mind does has to do with desire. And desires are a very important part of human life. Human life in a general way would not exist in any kind of meaningful way without desire. But the mind plays all kinds of tricks with desire and magic tricks that we get fooled and seduced and in awe and caught up in desires. And so part of the aspect of Buddhist practice is to become wise about desire. And we become wise about desire by studying it, by becoming familiar with it. And that's one of the purposes of mindfulness practice, is to start paying attention more carefully, not only to our life in general, but in particular to pay careful attention to desires when they arise, to understand how they work, and eventually understand the magic trick that might come along with them. The magic trick that maybe keeps us seduced in them or caught in them or reactive to them. And if we can see how that works or see something about the nature of desire and not be fooled by it, then some desires we'll lose interest in and some desires we'll learn to appreciate and value and maybe make them important part of our lives in a good way. So desire is to be studied, to be learned about. And one of the things to keep in mind as we look at desire is that for some people, desires are continuous. And the analogy in Buddhism is a monkey swinging from one branch to another in the forest, that just as the monkey grabs one branch, the other arm is swinging to grab the next. And so the mind will get one desire and then move on to the next one before that one's really taken in. And not a few people have discovered that, that they've had a strong burning desire for something. And finally it's fulfilled. And then they're already in the middle of, or having it fulfilled, the middle of getting what they want. They're thinking about the next desires, tomorrow, more. Sometimes the mind cannot be at rest or content with what it has because of the momentum of desiring more or other things. I remember when I was a little kid, I was probably 8 or 9, I really, really, really wanted something for Christmas. And my parents were not so inclined to get it. I think because it was a plastic machine gun. Something like that, or a plastic robot. I don't remember so well anymore, but I remember really wanting it, my parents not wanting to get it to me. So then they got it for me anyway, because I really wanted it. And my interest in this thing didn't last beyond even to the end of Christmas Day or something. It just it just kind of sat there in the room and was never used again. But it was so important, to have it. And it was, the magician had done the trick, and I had fell for it. So they can be incessant and ongoing and come from a lack of contentment, or just come from the incessant kind of flow of which desires can come so easily. And it might be interesting to reflect that an important part of human life is eating food, and being hungry and wanting food it can be a healthy and important part of life. But don't eat all the time. And I hope you're not only thinking about wanting food nonstop throughout the whole day. That makes life a little difficult and kind of truncates it and limits it. You know, there's a time and place to want food, time and place to eat food, but not all the time. So the same thing with desire. There's a time and place for desire, but not all the time. And one of the functions of meditation practice is to, there's many functions, but one of the important ones is to give us a palpable experience of being without desire, where especially the ordinary desires of our life are not present. And that's not meant to necessarily be critical of desire, all desire, but it's nice to have the experience of not having them. And some people are quick to want to defend them when they hear this, but we're just talking about a temporary stop. I know it's a little bit challenging for some people, the idea of having a vacation, workaholics. But, it's good to have a vacation, or it's good to sleep at night, and not be caught up in your desires. Some people can't fall asleep because they're caught in their desires. It's good to have a break from these things. And what happens in meditation is a very high quality break, because desires are kind of incessant or continuous. And meditation can show that. It's hard to see that without some high quality attention, to really kind of slow down and start paying attention to what goes on. And we can merrily go along our life, and we're kind of basically, I shouldn't say we, since I don't know about you, but I think there's a few of you, maybe, who are a little bit preoccupied with your thoughts as you go through your day. And new things happen and new desires happen, and we're so focusing on what we want or what we don't want, our desires, what's happening, our thoughts, that we don't pay much attention to the drive to have those thoughts. And there isn't that kind of deep, subjective kind of introspection. Meditation can provide that, mindfulness, where we stop. And one of the surprises that some people have with meditation is how much they think. They say that it's the first important insight is the insight that your mind's out of control with thought, just incessant. And we try to come back to the breath, we try focus on something, and the mind has other ideas and will take us off into our thoughts and come back. And it's surprising. Some people are shocked at how much their mind veers off, gallops off into thoughts, and how difficult it is to really be centered and quiet here. And that's an insight. That's beginning to see the trick, how the magician works, and how we get pulled into that world. And sometimes we have to see that really, really well. It's not a mistake that a mind does that, and it's not wrong that it does that. You're not bad because of it. But you are being fooled by the magic show. And so if you want to stop being fooled by it, you want to study it and really see it clearly. And sometimes it takes a lot of seeing, a lot of time, to understand this trick and how we get seduced by these thoughts, what drives them. But one of the insights to have as we start seeing how incessant the thinking can be is that a high percentage of thoughts could be seen as arising out of some kind of desire. They represent wanting something, both in terms of wanting something and not wanting it, negative desire. And there's actually a lot more desiring going on in human minds than simply wanting ordinary things in life. And so you can kind of, the flavor of desire, or the quality of desire kind of infuses even our most subtle kind of thinking. So when we come to meditate, it's not just stopping to think about surface desires, but it's seeing the underlying, quieting down the underlying desires that are fueling even our thinking. And as we sit and quiet the mind, we start kind of going through layers of the mind and see more and more subtle ways in which desire operates. And there's a whole range of desires which we can probably call subconscious that are operating, but we usually don't have much contact with them and awareness of them. And those desires, even though they're subconscious, so we don't necessarily know them, are influencing the show, influencing how we see, how we perceive, our bias, our preferences, what we look at, what we, you know, what we're interested in, influencing our desires. And so as we sit and quiet the mind, that subconscious layer slowly becomes revealed. One of the areas of this subconscious desire has to do with desires about self, self-identity, self-promotion, self-representation, how we want to represent ourselves, delusions of grandeur, you know, kind of stories about how great I am, I'm going to be something, or I want to, or delusions of, what's the opposite of grandeur? Delusions of, what? Louder. Delusions of inferiority. That's the good one. I wasn't quite, I thought that'd be a better one. Worthlessness. Delusions of worthlessness. I hope you hear the word delusion ahead of it. Delusions of grandeur, delusions of worthlessness. You know, the mind kind of spins this magic show, spins all these magic thoughts that we get hooked into and we believe. So these desires and that come along, and even the delusions of worthlessness can be fueled by certain kinds of desires. And one of them is this desire to be something, to be someone. And to have that frustrated or taken away from us or be criticized can be very difficult and kind of translates to all kinds of ideas about ourselves. And so this desire to be someone, and then more subtly, even the desire to be turns out to be a desire. The desire to exist. One more dramatic form it takes is the desire to be alive, stay alive, desire not to die. I mean, it seems like pretty basic human desire to have. And that's pretty deep in there. You know, it kind of helps us stay alive. If we want to stay alive, it's, you know, it can be a good thing. But it's still a desire that's there. And we can get pulled into it sometimes in unhealthy ways or unnecessary ways or something. So meditation is one of those places in life where it's meant to be safe, appropriate, to take a break from desires. In order to do that, we use desire to come to the end of desire. Because it is a desire to put our desires to rest. It is a, you know, so, and so some people, like, can hear certain Buddhist teachings, think, I'm not supposed to have any desires now. And, if you think that way too much, then the only option is to be depressed. I think sometimes that's a symptom of depression, is to have no desires. But it's fine to have desires, but we want to be wise about them. We want to have the right desires and be able to use desires appropriately. And it's appropriate desire in the context of meditation to have some simple desire, not a craving, not a demand or expectation, a desire that, yes, this is a good direction to go, to quiet this mind down, to let go of the desires I usually have, and to tune in to that part of my life, to being alive, that's not driven by desire or influenced by desire or covered over by desire or preoccupied with desire. Is there something, do you have something available here as you sit and breathe that is not somehow influenced by desire or caught in it? Are there desirelessness places within you? Are there places within you of being content and just being settled and peaceful? Are there parts of you that is not being influenced by desire? If I sit down to meditate sometimes, I can see that the effect of my desires as I live my life, sometimes I feel the desires in the subtle tensions of my muscles. Because, you know, if I want something, my arms are engaged, you know, like, well, you really want something. And so there's subtle tension of my arms. And that tension doesn't necessarily drop away just because I sit quietly. Sometimes I feel the leftover tension in my arms and my shoulders or the stomach or different places that is there from those desires that I've been living with for a while. And so some of the muscles you can feel that still involve the desire. But are there other places in your body where there is not caught up in desire? Is your little toe desire-free? You know, sometimes it's not. Is your back, you know, the muscles of your back rib cage, are they desire-free? Can you find some place in your body, it's kind of a reference point for, you know, something that doesn't involve and caught up in desire. Can your breathing be desire-free? Sometimes meditators are caught up in all kinds of desires about their breath. They're supposed to have a deep breath or a quiet breath or a still breath, or their breath should be this way, or the breath is supposed to get them concentrated. I want to get concentrated. I'm going to hold on to that breath so I can get concentrated. And we tie ourselves in knots with these desires. But to have an easy breath, a breath that the breathing itself has no desire. The body knows how to breathe perfectly well without you, without your conscious effort. So to sit down and be able to just let the body breathe without any entanglement with desire. So to discover that parts of you where there's no desire, even if there's simultaneously there are places of desire. So you begin seeing is desires are not the whole picture, the whole story. And then some of these things, to have the trust or the confidence to begin softening and relaxing the mind so the mind and yourself can be at rest and at ease without having to get anything, without needing to want anything. To discover what that's like, to have the trust and the confidence. Some people don't have that trust and confidence, so there's another route that some people take, and that is they become sensitive to how unpleasant it is to be involved in desire. And that takes a while, because for some desires, they are they're kind of pleasant. And that's part of the hook. That's how the magic trick works. We have pleasant fantasies. And some people love having anticipatory desires. And some people, the anticipation of having a desire, getting something, is actually more fun than getting it. And so they, you know, spend a lot of time anticipating. Some people create whole... And they become kind of anticipatory fantasy experts. And that's they spend a lot of time in their life anticipating. And there's a lot of hope and promise in fantasy that's maybe more, you know, grander than reality. So this idea of kind of... And also some people with desire feel a certain kind of aliveness. It can be energy that come along with desire. And you have desire, you feel kind of alive. And some people want to feel alive and vital, and that kind of has meaning or something. And so that's another hook to it. But if you pay careful attention to desire when you sit and meditate, especially, there's aspects of desire which are unpleasant. There's a kind of strain or stress involved. Sometimes there's a kind of a tiredness involved, a kind of a weariness. There's a kind of you kind of start feeling there's some quality of it is unsatisfactory. And for some people, that's what helps them to let go. Okay, I see now what's going on. I don't want that. I'm going to give myself a break. Give myself a break. Not now. Not now. Not now. And slowly, and it might take quite a while, but we start experiencing the lessening of desires. And at first, it might be some of the large desires of our life. And we feel that it's possible to be alive. It's possible to feel content. It's possible to feel actually quite good about oneself without fulfilling some of the desires we thought we needed to fulfill in order to feel good. To see that and feel that is a cornucopian revolution. Is that the right word? That's not the right word. Copernicus. Something closer. it's a real revolution, and that to realize that you don't have to fulfill many of the surface desires, many of the common desires that people have in order to be happy. You don't have to have, you know, the perfect relationship. I've known people who have anticipated having a perfect relationship, thought that person was the perfect person, put a lot of time and effort into it, got married, and then they woke up one morning and looked across the breakfast table. What have I done? Uh, the magic trick, you know. It would be good if you see how the magic trick works earlier. And but you know, this idea, the perfect relationship, only if I have that, then I'll be happy. The perfect job, the perfect this, the perfect, you know, bank account, the perfect vacation, the perfect, you know, just whatever it might be. And and some people only feel fulfilled if they certain ideals of desires are fulfilled. But to have a high quality, and I want to emphasize high quality, sense of being alive and present and just kind of being, no desires, no ordinary desires fulfilled, and feel happy. The most sustained periods of happiness I've had in my life that lasted for months came not from fulfilling a ordinary desire in the world. I had a desire to sit and meditate, but that was a lot, but in doing that, I was just letting go of a lot of thoughts, letting go of my desires. So to really to experience this high quality good, the goodness of it, or the rightness of it, or the fulfillment of sitting without being caught up in desires, for some people is a radical shift to see that that's possible. It kind of you understand there's you know, more games in town. You know, there's another way of living. You don't have to put all your eggs in the basket of conventional desires and fulfillment and getting things. There's another, you know, you can put yourself in this other basket of just being peaceful and alive. So to quiet and settle the desires and have ultimately in Buddhism, Buddhism points to an experience of radical, complete cessation of desire. And that's a whole game changer. And one way it's a game changer is that then one understands it's easier to understand the nature of desire in a whole different way. It's easier to see that there is another alternative, a radically good alternative to having desires. So desires are now held more lightly. They're not taken quite as seriously as they were before. With this full cessation of desire, it's kind of like we have a clean slate or something where we can see more clearly the nature of desire when it arises. You know, if you're swirling in a sea of desires, you can't really see one desire from the other, perhaps. But if you have the experience of all desires are quieted enough, then a desire arises, you can see it clearly. So this radical cessation of desire, or the quieting desire, helps us to see desires in a new way. And in seeing desires in a new way, the hope is that we can see which desires are healthy and useful, helpful, and which desires are not. We're more likely not to be fooled by the seductive power of some of these desires, the authority, the messages of some of these that come along, that if I have this, will I be fulfilled. But we start seeing that there are some desires which are nourishing in a deep way, some of the desires which seem to help us stay free, open, not contracted, not constricted, not caught up in the compulsion of desire, but rather certain kind of desires which help us support us to be compulsive free, to have freedom in the realm of desires. A desire arises, and we can see it for what it is, and we have the wherewithal to see, no thank you, and it just goes. Or we have the wherewithal to say, oh, this is useful. This is a desire to pursue. It's not easy, it's going to take a lot of effort, but this is worthwhile to do. And some of the extra things we do with desire aren't weighing it down. And one of the extra things we do with desire has to do with this self thing, self-identity, self-representation, proving ourselves, apologizing for ourselves, fixing ourselves, building ourselves up. All this kind of enterprise of selfing that human beings do make desires more complicated than they need to be. So if this whole kind of desire around being a self has quieted as well, that helps us to make much simpler relationship with our desires. And we just have a desire. So all this is to say, to encourage, I hope this can be encouragement, for you to become a student of your desires. Don't take them for granted. Don't let them take you for granted. Notice how your desires sometimes have you, as opposed to you having your desires. Notice how they work. Notice what they are. Maybe do an inventory of desires. Sometimes people have no one's, very few people have sat down and actually done a wonderful inventory of your desires and kind of see which ones are the common ones and what are the uncommon ones and how do they work and what goes on and how do you relate to your desires? What are your beliefs connected to your desires? What is your sense of self connected to your desires? What desires come with demand, expectation? What desires are easily frustrated? What's going on there? It's a whole kind of world to discover. So I was motivated to give this talk on desire by receiving yesterday in the mail a program for a memorial service of a person from who used to be part of our community here for many years. His name was, some of you might remember, Frank Ryerson. And Frank died last year, last maybe June or something. And so in July, they had a memorial service, and someone just yesterday I received a copy. I wasn't there, but I got a copy of the memorial service. So that was kind of nice, and it's a picture of him. It was nice for me to see him. And I'd seen him some months before he died. He came here to see me, and he was happiest he'd been in his whole life. He knew he was dying, and I kind of like, you're dying. Are you really happy? Is this real? And he was definitely was real. He was relaxed. He was completely like he was living his life to the full in a certain kind of way. He was just really here. He was really happy. And so I opened this program, and there was a poem by him. So I never. He was an English professor. He was a high school English teacher. So it relates to this topic of desire, though he uses the word hunger, which is a certain kind of desire, that's more compulsive. And after the poem, there's a poem by the Japanese poet Basho that I'll read first because it's a little bit sets a context for his poem. And Basho writes, even in Kyoto, hearing the gull's cry, I long for Kyoto. These desires. Even when you have what you want, you get caught up in desire wanting. So Frank wrote this. And the title of this poem is Nothing is Enough. Nothing is enough, or everything is not enough. I have a hunger beyond any object it chooses, a hunger never still nor satisfied, only occupied for moments. The hunger is and is not me. I can't outrun it, and if I feed it, it wants more. Mostly, it wants something else. A wise person said, stop, hold still for a bit, and you will be used eventually. You'll become the instrument of what needs to be said. You might be lucky this way, become nothing. Then nothing is enough. Two meanings of nothing is enough. Which do you prefer? The part of the poem that I want to most emphasize here, a wise person said, stop, hold still for a bit. And that's what I was trying to teach here. It's the value of stop your desires, just be still. And I love this idea, just for a bit. It's not like you have to, like, once and for all, let go of every possible desire and, you know, just be a couch potato. But for a bit, for a bit. But then what follows is what I think quite remarkable and deep. And then eventually, you will then be used eventually. You'll be used. You will become the instrument of what needs to be said. So what he's pointing to here is at some point, if you get still and stop enough and don't kind of have your ordinary desires, maybe selfish desires, or stop, and eventually you wait and listen, you can hear or feel or discover that something wants to move through you to speak, to do, to help, to do something that comes from a different place than what you can say, this is me. It's you, it's coming out of you in a sense, but it's not something you take so personally. You become an instrument for what wants to be said, as opposed to being, you become the speaker. Look how great I am, I'm a great speaker, thank you. As opposed to, you know, this is just coming through me, kind of. And so this idea of stopping the desires or quieting down, discovering a new, not just new desires and healthy desires, but discovering a different way in which desires can arise in us. They can arise from some place that is not so coagulated or contracted around self and around fear and around greed and around, you know, being defensive and getting. But something that, someplace that feels very natural and free, it bubbles up or it flows through or it comes, and you can't quite take credit for it. And what good is it if you can't take credit for it? I mean, it's all about getting things for yourself, right? And, you know, it's all about you. Turns out that there's a whole other life that's very rich, very meaningful, that doesn't, it's not based on this paradigm, it's all about me. And not even about all about you. You become an instrument for the goodness in your heart. You become an instrument for something profound that can move through you in response to this world. And but to allow that which is good inside of you to respond freely to the world and wisely to the world does require that all those surface desires, all that swirl desires, all the monkey mind that's caught up in desires and wanting of all the forms, and positive desires and negative desires, the expectations that come with desires, the fantasies that come with desires, the frustrations, the whole world, somehow begin to become quiet and still. And then you can listen to something or hear something else that wants to come through. And that's a beautiful thing. There is beauty. There is goodness in you. And it's waiting, if you haven't already tapped into it. And the way to access it is to not be tricked by the magic show. To see how the magic is done, to understand the nature of these desires, the nature of our involvement and identification with them, and to have access to a different source within us, a different place, where we can be live in the world in a free way, in a compassionate way, loving way, generous way, not because we are that way, intentionally or in a way that we can claim it's me. It's just we're the instrument for that. We're an instrument for love, an instrument for kindness, responsiveness, support for this world of ours. So become a student of your desires and then graduate. So thank you for this morning, and I hope that you find it enlivening and engaging to study yourself in this way. Thank you.